And we're live with our 308th episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. We are back for 2026. Happy to be here. It's been an extended break for us, right? Typically, we don't take as much of a break over the holiday, but this year it just worked out that way. But we're super excited to be back with Avi today. We're going to dig into all things OWASP and do short introductions and all of that momentarily. I did have a couple of announcements before we launch into it, though. We've got a few trainings that are going to be available for listeners attached with conferences so far. First up, is KernelCon, the beginning of April. We will be teaching harnessing LLMs at KernelCon. We were not there this last year, but have been there for a couple of years teaching practical secure code review. So we'll see how things go. This is a great opportunity for you to jump in and learn about LLMs, how to utilize them for your application security program. And then we've got two opportunities in Singapore, right? So first up is Black Hat Asia, where we will be teaching a combined course of secure code review and harnessing LLMs, where we're actually going to implement secure code review using LLMs and the basics of both of those courses. That is a special Black Hat course for Black Hat Asia. We're reprising what we did in Black Hat Europe a couple months ago. And then also just announced is DEF CON trainings. So for DEF CON Singapore, we're going to be doing harnessing LLMs there as well. So it's going to be a lot of teaching for Ken and I. For I think in 8 days, we teach, what, six of them or seven of them, something like that. I'm pretty sure we're going to be fried, but it's going to be a good opportunity. We're going to talk a lot about AI, as usual, right? Like, that seems to be our favorite topic the last 6 months. So we do have the opportunities available. Reach out if you have questions about either of those. I'll post some links where they are available. They will be up on training.absoluteappsec.com this afternoon as well, but I'll post the links to the actual trainings themselves where you can register. Ken, anything else you want to call out? I don't know if you want to talk through the training we did in at Europe, or should we just dive straight in and talk with Avi?
Probably just dive straight in. You know, we have these always go really quickly. So we could start with Avi, the founder and CEO of Bound Security and global board of directors for OWASP. Let's get right into it with Avi.
Correction, again, as of 2 weeks ago, I'm no longer on the board of directors. I fulfilled my two terms, got kicked off the board, rolled off the board, and that's it. I'm a free agent now.
Oh, nice. Well, maybe you have more free time, I guess, perhaps.
Well, you'd think, wouldn't you? But don't worry, there's plenty of other awesome stuff to fill the void.
Especially these days.
For example, I'm working now on organizing AppSec Israel Conference in May. Ooh. This is likely to be one of, if not the largest, AppSec conference. Rivaling the global AppSec in size. It's only 1 day, but packed with highly technical, very developer-focused very often, and one of the most vibrant communities there are. I'm also working on a couple of projects, the threat modeling project with a new version, recently rebooted with Adam Shostak at the helm and a bunch of other amazing leaders on that, and the application privacy reference project as well, with a couple of fantastic co-leaders, Izar Tarandak, Matt Coles, and of course, the brilliant Kim Lutz. And I'm also joining a couple of committees. So I'm filling my free time, my free OWASP time with a bunch of other stuff as well.
I take it back. You have no free time. That's a lot of stuff, just to say it out loud. But what's the privacy project I hadn't heard about, actually? I'm gonna Google that right now.
Yeah, it's just getting started now. We haven't really published any deliverables just yet, any actual usable thing. But what we're doing is we're doing a bunch of things around application privacy. just for background, Kim Lutz and I did a training at Black Hat as well, 2-day training at Black Hat US around application privacy, how to implement this. I'm not talking about compliancy stuff. I'm not talking about regulations. I'm talking about what are the practical things that we need to know when we build systems. Almost privacy threat modeling, but more than that, the privacy architecture. And we touched on a whole lot of stuff. So we realized we need to turn this into some actionable guidelines. So one of the things that we're working on is the APVS, Application Privacy Verification Standard, similar to the ASVS, but for privacy requirements. We're working on a privacy risk replacement for that, privacy prioritization for that, and a bunch of other stuff around that that developers, architects, product managers need to be able to say, okay, these are the practical things that I need to be able to go off and build a privacy-respecting application. And I'm not talking about legal. It's not just not illegal, but it's actually better. Privacy has a value.
Right. Interesting. Logging.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Seth's favorite. Sorry, I'm going to... I shouldn't have said that. Now we got Seth involved. He's...
Now I'm going to pipe up. Yeah. So I posted a link to the course that you taught at Black Hat, right? I haven't like reviewed this quite yet, but this is an interesting topic because I'm hearing more and more kind of about privacy in applications and, you know, what led to the development of this course and like this project and kind of, the goals behind it. Like where did it come from? I guess is my main question.
Sure. Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And I'm going to talk about from my perspective. The industry will have its own perspective. But for me, it really started when working a few years ago on the Threat Modeling Manifesto. Uh-huh. Brilliant group, you know, 15 people, if the listeners are interested, threatmodelingmanifesto.org. There you go. And it's basically a high-level view of what threat modeling should be without being specific about how to do it, but rather the goals and what it should serve. We also had another an add-on for that, the capabilities for your practice. And of course, one of the things we're talking about in the manifesto is that it's not just security. There's other aspects, for example, privacy. And from that, I started collaborating a lot closer with Kim Lutz, who, by the way, is one of the leading researchers for application privacy, as we're calling it, or privacy threat modeling specifically the Lindon threat modeling framework. And I started collaborating with her how to bring privacy requirements into the world of security, right? So we started doing a couple of talks together about combining this, going to security conferences to talk privacy. And at the time, a few years ago, this was kind of rare and people didn't really know why, but then it made a lot of sense. So of course she's bringing the privacy expertise and I'm translating this to security engineering. And then we said, you know what? It's not just enough to build awareness. Let's actually teach how to do this. And then we started working on the course. We delivered this last year, or 2024, at AppSec Lisbon. And that was fantastic. One of the greatest experiences that I had with a first edition of a training. As you guys know, first time you build a new course, it's rocky, it's bumpy. But this one's
so... Right. I always bring a notebook, and then like Seth and I will sit there, and as we're giving training, if we realize like a slide, whatever, needs to be cleaned up, or yeah, like you're saying, like it is rough in the beginning. So I'll always sit there and just make annotations, and then it takes like multiple course runs to actually get to that point where it's smooth. And yeah, so anyways, not to interrupt.
Yeah, and listen, there's always going to be changes, always updates. But sometimes you put a slide up and it doesn't resonate with the class, and sometimes they don't really get what you're talking about. But we had this amazing experience that people were sitting there and you saw this visceral look of like, oh, hell no, no, now I understand that, hell no. And it was just this visceral feeling of, okay, that is exactly what we didn't realize we wanted to achieve. Because once you understand it, because privacy isn't just technical like security, right? It's, mm-hmm. it's a lot fuzzier. It's a lot. We started calling this the cringe factor. That's really hard to formalize but you know it when you see it. The next version of this, by the way, where I'm really proud of this, we are publishing a card game to build this called Context and Cringe. And this is being published. We actually literally won an award. Allow me to hype myself here. We literally won an award by CyberSec Games from Agile Stationery, the ones who publish all the security games. And they're publishing the game. We're working out, we're finalizing the last design details right now. It should go on pre-sale in like a week or two. And people that have played this is like, oh my God, this is so such an amazing experience of you make one small change to the context of the application, and it changes the whole feel of what that context, what that cringe feeling gets you. So the idea is that for security champions or privacy champions or product managers, you start playing this and you start getting a feel for what are these changes? You know, what effects does this actually cause the privacy feeling, right? Privacy respecting of the application. And all this comes to be able to capture that knowledge of how to build an application that is privacy respecting and not just not illegal.
Yeah, actually, I was going to ask you, like, who you know, for threat modeling and for privacy, do you have any opinions on who should attend courses like that? Like how, and not just the course and who should attend, but just sort of how, do you have like a model in your head yet of how you foresee, you mentioned product, you mentioned product managers, you mentioned engineers, you mentioned security. I think you mentioned probably maybe one or two other groups I don't remember, but do you have a picture for your ideal state inside of an organization, how people conceptualize the stuff that's being shipped and who should be taking ownership or, yeah, curious your thoughts there.
Yeah, so for security threat modeling, I most prefer, I most enjoy teaching developers, right? Because you can do threat modeling. I have a very, very pragmatic, non-formal approach, very lightweight. And you can do this in the course of, yeah, you could spend 2 months doing the threat modeling for your system. You could spend 90 minutes, or you could spend 2 minutes on this user story or less, right? So I have the most fun teaching developers and product managers, DevOps too sometimes. Having them in the room always changes the view. And I teach a very collaborative way. So it's more of a discussion rather than here's a checklist. Right? Mm-hmm. So that's for security threat modeling. For privacy, I like to abstract and zoom out a little bit more. And product managers, software architects, and security engineers kind of need to hear this as well. Privacy used to be part of security, right? It's data protection to some extent. It's just changing your focus of who it is we're protecting, whose data, who the threats are, and what we need to care about. And yet we kind of lost that a few decades ago for security. So a lot of times security engineers are responsible for this, but don't really have that mindset or the tooling or the tools to think about that aspect.
Yeah, I mean, you start to talk about it and I start to think about the CIA, like the confidentiality, you know, triad, right? Like, and integrity as well, but it's more confidentiality, like how your system or how your application actually, well, protects data, but protection and privacy are kind of like, yes, they're related, but it's not quite the same thing, right? Like how you handle that. And then you like, you start talking about data classification and what it is to actually be private. It becomes fairly fascinating to me, especially in the age of AI, as we're introducing chatbots or we're starting to send this data to third-party systems. Like the application itself is no longer an isolated actor when it comes to data. It's usually sending things out to third-party services, it's got proxies, it's got all of these different interactions that actually happen. And it's a minefield, to your point, right? Like it becomes a privacy minefield on how you actually protect. I mean, I'm going back to my day-to-day of being a consultant for organizations, and there's very few that think beyond GDPR.
Yeah.
Very
few. 100%, Seth. And the interesting thing is that Yeah, confidentiality is almost, it's almost binary, right? Do you protect this from the people who are not allowed to see it, do own, right? From a security perspective. But with privacy, it's a lot more nuanced, and it's so much more subjective. Am I okay with you seeing this piece of my sensitive data? Maybe. Is Ken okay with that? The same data about him? Maybe not. There is so much more context here, hence the context in cringe. So much more context, and it's so much more subjective. There's several layers of what context actually means. What context means is depends on the context you're using the word. It's one of those better words. So it becomes complicated, nuanced, contextual, and sometimes very subjective per person. And you need to be able to capture all of that. It's so much different from just, is this confidential or not?
Yeah, I mean, I start to think of the gradients, to your point, right? Like it being subjective and context matters. Like even just attendees to conferences like, you know, AppSec USA or one of the global AppSec conferences versus who goes to DEF CON, and you have the people that show up and wear masks the entire time and, you know, put their hoodies up and only use their handle, all that sort of thing. And you have other people that are very open about it. And, hey, this is who I am in the real world. And, like, this is just who we are, right? Like, I mean, I think we have a tendency, Ken and I at least, to be a little bit more public in that sphere. But there are those that are absolutely not, right? Like, especially the kind of the old hats that were around 25 years ago, we only knew them by their handle. And they were very careful about doxing themselves. And so designing a system for both of those people, those like extremes, is a difficult prospect.
Absolutely. And it's not linear. Right? Those people that will only go by a handle and nobody wear a mask, they might be less sensitive to privacy in other parts of it. Whereas you and I are, you know, we're all three of us are very public because we're on stage all the time. And I don't know about you, but I am very protective about privacy in other areas of my life. Mm-hmm. So it's not linear, and it's not directly, you can't directly conclude what a person will want from that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a lot fuzzier. Humans are messy.
Yeah.
And privacy is not a technical thing. It is technical, but it's also very human oriented.
So what is your baseline kind of recommendation for that, right? Like without digging too much into Lindon or the training itself, how do you recommend that developers approach privacy when there is that, when it is so fuzzy?
So that's exactly why we started writing up the APVS, to write out detailed recommendations of exactly, you know, what you need to be doing as requirements to the system, just like ASVS. I'll start with number one, start with data minimization. Don't collect data if you don't need it. Don't use data if you don't need it. Start with that. That I think is probably the easiest tip to convey to start with. Not so easy to implement always. Right. And sometimes really just the question of, do you even care about who your individuals are? Right. It's not just the users. Do you care about individuals or not? And if you do care, well, then follow through with that. Give a moment to think about it. Figure out who they are, what their context is, what their life is. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes you can make some conclusions from that, but you still won't know everything. So it's really just a question of having that model in place of your perspective of who they are, what they want, what their feelings are in relation to this. And the less data of theirs that you have, the less you need to worry about that.
But that, I mean, that's almost a complete 180 from what most applications do, right? Like you think about the tracking that goes on, you think about all of the, you know, the data that's being collected for advertising and, you know, user interface, UX activities, like all of that that's actually happening. we have a tendency to want more data, not actually scope down to less. I don't, like I said, I'm stepping into this conversation from my perspective as a consultant that's talking to multiple organizations, and I don't see them going that route. If anything, we have to push back when we look and say, really, guys, right? Like, why are we sharing, you know, social security numbers or, you know, digital identifiers about users with everyone that's out there in like logging into your application? That's what I see more of. And so having that conversation is going to, it's just a shift. That's all I'm getting to there. Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. And that's often the discussion that we have. That's why I said it's the easiest to explain, not so easy to actually implement, right? Because so many businesses are driven by data, whether they're selling the data or advertising based on that data, or trying to do any kind of business analytics and figuring out how to micro segment your customers. Sure. But then when you put it in the light of, well, this actually violates these individuals' privacy and they might not sign up and give you their data because of that. Sometimes you just saying that does not help, but getting that, when you get that feeling of, oh, now I feel their cringe, now I understand that perspective of that. That is a point of discussion now to say, okay, maybe we need to take this into account, because you know what? If they don't give us their data, we won't have the data. So it's a very delicate balancing act, right? How do we collect the least amount of socially cringy accepted data versus how much can I get without violating their cringe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, okay. So, okay, we're having this discussion on data privacy, and like, you're coming at it from designing a framework or a verification standard. I'm looking at it from, okay, I'm talking to all these clients, I'm not seeing anything. Yep. Ken, you're developing a product, right? Like, when it comes to privacy, like, I mean, I guess most of your client data is code related. So, but you know, there is still some user data that's in there. Is that something that you've considered?
Well, yeah, for sure. Yes. But I was actually going to mention, since you mentioned product, that when we see people put custom, like, you know, we have the custom policy thing where we enforce policies against like pull and merge requests. We see that the number one thing is around sensitive data and private data, PII, PHI being logged. So most of the time, that is the number one thing that people come in and build first is, like, you know, to your point, they'll have and I guess this is going to be interesting to hear from you two on this, but it seems like they have pretty much like data classification standards already mapped out, and they know what falls in or outside of that. Though even with that information, sometimes people don't seem to have a very good handle on exact, it takes time to get to a level where they understand basically and have protected all, without being noisy, all ways that they could potentially PII, PHI. And what's funny is when you watch these things run, there's like a million ways you can expose private data. And it's not always super obvious too. So anyways, just, it's interesting that we're having this conversation, because yeah, that's the number one problem it seems like people try to solve in their, with technical control wise, I mean. Mm-hmm. And do you guys see data classification documentation? Or sorry, go ahead, Appy.
Sorry. Okay. I was just going to say, point out, you know, when it comes to some of that data, yeah, we need to know location, right? Do you need to know, have precise GPS coordinates? Do you need to have an exact address? Or perhaps you're just collecting demographic information and the city alone is enough, or the region that is enough. And you can still collect that data just at a lower resolution. Do you need my exact birth date and the time that I was birthed? Or just, you need my age range and decade, right? There's a range. Data is not binary. There's always a continuum of how much of that data I'm collecting. And our default is, let's just take it and figure it out later. Doesn't need to be that.
Yeah, well, and like, it's funny because I'm watching, you know, like, obviously vibe coding is a big part of everybody's workflow now. And it's funny because you watch and I'll notice the AI generated reviewers, like functional reviewers, mention things like, hey, you're now taking this object, or you're, you know, maybe you're creating and crafting some kind of JSON body, or you're serializing in some way And like, do you realize that you've now deserialized this object or put onto, like, I'm thinking of, think of like RESTful APIs, GraphQL APIs, things like that, where you could, you know, add something that's seemingly innocuous, but then a bunch of attributes are attached to that thing, or a bunch of data is attached to that thing. And so I'm seeing like both AI generated code write that, write those flaw, those types of flaws constantly, but I'm also watching like AI tools catch that constantly. So that is also another, it's, it, it becomes very clear to me that it's very difficult to detect a leak of what may or may not be considered private data these days. And I don't know, like it's interesting because, you know, speaking about those custom policies, when people write them to begin with, it's funny how little, to your point about people knowing, you know, where things are flowing, what things are considered private. Like the question was, are we logging or storing anything sensitively, that's sensitive insecurely or something like that, something very broad. And it's like, you watch people start there and then get down to a point where like, oh, I actually have to like kind of understand what are the kinds of private data that might be coming through here and where could they be flowing potentially. So yeah, it's interesting to see people kind of go through that evolution. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Education about their own applications. It's a tough thing though. I'm just saying it out loud. It's very tough to prevent private data. And actually, I mean, I guess that's another question is, this is for architecting. It sounds like it's more awareness so that as you are building things, as you are shipping things, you are thinking about these types of scenarios. But yeah, I don't know if there's more pragmatic or more dogmatic, maybe is a better way to say it, guidance as well, more than just like think about privacy or, yeah.
Well, awareness is obviously the first step, right? If you're not going to think about it, you're not going to find the problems, right? You might not be doing evil, but you're also not doing good. Just by default. By default, you're going to be collecting so much data and violating people's privacy by default. Exactly.
Yes, that's fair.
Yeah, that's fair.
I'll point out, Bobby, though, but usually I assume you're talking about putting your own SSN in that. And that's your choice. Anybody can choose to expose their own data. The problem is, what if I'm putting in Seth's SSN in my, by the way, here's Seth's SSN. That is completely different because then we get into what is often considered the first step, but it's really the last fallback of consent. Consent is super important, but here it's a question of, well, I really need to do that at least. The very least I can do is to get his consent before I post it. And respect that lack of consent as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, I mean, it feels like a non-trivial task. I'll be interested to see the verification standard when you come out with it. Like I can see this being extremely helpful. I mean, Bobby did bring up in the, like his chat as well, like talking to legal, like what sort of legal ramifications are associated with privacy data. It's interesting to be on a call when security engineers, developers are talking to legal, because legal has a very different viewpoint when it comes to privacy and risks associated with it, right? Like they are thinking from a legal perspective, what happens to the company when we expose those social security numbers that we have access to, or PCI or whatever else it actually is, becomes a different conversation than just, oh, this person put in some data about themselves and we display it in their profile. It's also like, what are we on the hook for if we do accidentally expose that to people that it wasn't intended for?
Yeah. And the interesting thing is, if you put product managers in that room, they will have a different view of risk. And when they realize, and I've had this conversation, it's like, yeah, of course I'm going to collect that data. Oh, but you know, one third of your potential customer or users won't sign up if you are asking for that information and you lose signups. That is now a different conversation. Now we're talking about product risk and not legal risk. Mm-hmm. And honestly, that is where I prefer to focus. Not a lawyer, my father was. I don't find legal regulations and all that stuff to be that exciting from a technical perspective. It's important, of course. That's where you get the teeth from, of course. But it becomes a lot more nuanced when you think about that from a product perspective.
Yeah. Well, good. Yeah. So, well, keep us up to date because I'd like to see the game as well as you launch that. And like when the standard comes up, we will definitely post that and probably have a conversation about it at the very least. Right?
Can I also hype training as long as we mentioned? Because we're going to be delivering a one-day version of this, of the same Black Hat training, a subset of that, more focused on how this integrates with AI systems or how AI integrates with that, how privacy affects that, at OWASP London Training Days next month. And I'm hopeful, optimistic, we'll be doing it at AppSec Vienna in June as well. Don't know that for sure.
Cool. Yeah, that's good to hear. I mean, I'll continue the conversation. I don't know if we've got, you know, much else. I don't necessarily have other questions, but I did want to get to other topics because, you know, we only have 20 minutes left. Ken did post the AppSec IL link. What is it? So, like, let's talk quickly about that. And then I wanted to get into a little bit on your experience the last couple of years being on the OWASP board and how that has been. But can you talk a little bit about AppSec IL, what the goal behind it is, what you're expecting to see, right? Because I know Ken and I were at Global AppSec EU when it was in Tel Aviv a number of years ago. I think that was 2019.
Yeah. 2019, that's right, yeah.
Yep.
So you guys had a good time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was great, right? Like it was, it was fun. Yeah.
So listen, it started off as a local conference. So, you know, there's OWASP AppSec days all over the world. And this started in, I think, 2007 was the first version that we had. And up until COVID, it was continuous. Then we stopped. Then we came back. Then we had war. Then we came back again. So this year, it's going to be quiet, right? It's going to be bigger. So it's, we're expecting close to 1,000 people to attend. If you're considering travel, I will say, you know, Seth and Ken had a great experience coming to Tel Aviv. It's the perfect season for it in May, by the way, before it gets too hot, perfect beach weather, fantastic food, right? For all you foodies out there. And it's a great experience. The conference itself is both highly technical and very advanced, but also very accessible because we get a high percentage of developers attending there. There's a ton of security research going on, of course, in Israel. By the way, shout out to companies that might want to sponsor a conference. I'm the guy to talk to about that. And there's always very advanced. I think we're having three tracks this year. There's always very advanced stuff and also very, here's how to do processes and things like that. So it's going to be a fantastic community event. Like all OWASP conferences, it's about the community, right? You come and you talk to more people than you thought you could and have more interesting conversations than you do pretty much at any other event.
Well, actually, I remember the first day, the first morning that I was there in 2019 with Seth, went to get some breakfast and someone was like, oh, you from Absolute AppSec? And I was like, yeah. And you know, they were from, I don't know, London or something. And it was just cool because you met people. We got to meet people from all over the world that all kind of flew in for, just some intense training and conferencing. And it was a good show out. So I really, really enjoyed it. It's an easy flight too, at least from where I'm at. So maybe not for Seth.
It's a little bit longer for me, just a little bit, but
close to Europe, cool. Though.
Cool. All right, so let's talk about OWASP a little bit, right? You know, you have been a board member as recently as 2 weeks ago. overall, Ken and I have a lot of discussions on OWASP, right? Just in general, obviously it's kind of the gorilla in the room as far as application security is concerned. There's so much activity. There's so many projects. There's so many conferences and different personalities associated with OWASP. So my first question to you is like, what was your biggest proud moment, I guess, or accomplishment that you had on the OWASP board? What are you most proud of that you did over the course of those couple of years?
Oh, that's a really good question. And I haven't had time to sit down and actually reflect back on all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a lot of proud moments. But we've also had a lot of, I got on the board 4 years ago, right? And for those that don't know, board terms are 2 years and you can have a maximum of two in a row. So I've been on the board for 4 years, which means that I basically started smack dab in the middle of the COVID, pandemic.
Yeah.
Which means that the organization was in the midst of a reinvention, because if the main thing was conferences, and it still is a big thing, but we had a few years of no conferences, how does the organization fund itself? How does the community meet up? So we went through a hard time, and the fact that we got through that, I think, is more can be attributed to the staff that did an amazing job pulling through and kind of in very short order figured stuff out. And being part of that also was very amazing. Coming back from that, and I think it was end of 2022, right, if I'm not mistaken, was the first big global AppSec post COVID, and kept getting bigger and growing and doing amazing things. Being able to reboot that and growing all the projects, we have hundreds of amazing projects that are getting bigger and greater now. We have hundreds of chapters worldwide. And that this is growing, right? Most recently, I don't know the most proud, but most recently, what does the board do, right? We create policies. That's what we do. We pass motions. We have discussions. We recently we're changing how the board is created and run, including the elections process, the qualifications, and all that stuff, to ensure that going forward, the board just gets better. They wouldn't let people like me on the board anymore, right? What's the thing about Groucho Marx? Don't want to be part of it that they let you be part of. Just making it better and stronger and raising the bar for that and getting people more interested. And I think, as I'm speaking, I think one of the things that I'm most proud of is increasing volunteerism.
Okay.
Yeah. We did a lot of that, and I had a lot of part of that, because that's what OWASP is. Right? It's a huge community. As you said, it's the gorilla in the room. It's the gorilla in every room when it comes to AppSec. And it's run by staff of seven.
Yeah.
Not 700, seven people on a shoestring budget, right? Because it's based on volunteers worldwide. We have hundreds, if not thousands, of volunteers. We have tens of thousands of people participating in the community, right? And this is all done by getting people to step up and do more. And this is how I got into OWASP, right? Oh, you want to do something? That's fantastic, brilliant. Here, go and do it yourself. You're up. You want something done? Yep, you're in.
Yeah.
And that's how we work. That's what OWASP is. That's what volunteerism is all about. And especially the past couple of years, I've seen this really, really explode to some projects that have dozens of contributors, some even more. More projects being more active, more stuff happening, more people stepping up and saying, yes, I will be part of this. Yes, I will help carry that load. Mm-hmm. And I think that's brilliant. I think that's amazing.
Yeah, volunteers is great, but also it connects you network-wise. And this is like something where people, I don't know why, because I don't have any frame of reference anymore on this, but people will still ask, and I'm sure Seth and Avi, you both get this. They'll ask like, well, I'm trying to, build out my career. I'm trying to get in, break in. I see on Reddit too. Like I see Reddit people that are like, I'll never get a job in cybersecurity. And, I look at what they care about and I'm like, well, yeah, certificates are great and all that fun stuff. But if you're not out there networking with people and making those connections, good luck. And the best way to do that is to volunteer, whether that's at a conference or through OWASP projects or any of it. And I don't think that that's gone away at all. I don't think that's changed at all. So, there are some good, I guess, selfish, and there's good selfless and good selfish reasons to go and do some volunteer work. For me, I can tell you it's always been a good outcome whenever I volunteer.
Yeah. Let's talk about the selfish reasons for a moment, right? I can talk about the jobs that I got offered because I'm very visible in OWASP, and I took at least two jobs that I got offered. As a consultant, Bounce Security is a consulting agency. I get tons of projects through this all the time simply by being visible. Oh, you're on the board. You must be an expert. I mean, I might be, but being on the board has nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
But yet, the thing about volunteering at conferences, I'm sure a lot of your listeners will agree, so many of us got into the industry to work with computers so we don't have to talk to people, right? A lot of us are shy introverts. You can't tell that on me, but I really am. And, you know, we found out that, well, actually, you do need to talk to people. You do need to actually communicate and build up it, no matter what you're doing. Even as, I don't know, a technical pen tester, you still have to write the report and communicate it to your client, right? No matter what you're doing. And being part of OWASP, I learned sales, marketing. I learned a lot of stuff doing this thing for OWASP. It's easier to sell somebody else, right? And volunteering at a conference, it takes a lot of that introvertedness, you know, cringe feeling away from you. I was like, no, you're on the job. You're standing behind a table. You have that space. And it gives you an excuse to talk to people and a frame. And you know what? It gives you an excuse to walk away because you have other jobs you have to do. So it gives, it's the perfect shield to be able to, for those shy introverts that don't like or don't feel comfortable talking to people, it gives you that framework to do that comfortably.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, no small talk. It's not even call it shyness for me. I just hate small talk. What are we talking about? It's nonsense. Like, let's talk about stuff that matters. I talk about the universe more than I would want to talk about like the weather outside, right? So like, let's not do that. And you're right. It's like, you have a function, you have a purpose. We can talk about that. There's at least some meaning to our conversation. So I think many ways. Sorry, Seth. I can tell you were about to say something. I've interrupted.
No. Or were you gonna? You're good. I mean, you're absolutely right. Like from a shyness perspective or introvert perspective, I still think one of the best things about OWASP, like the chapter specifically, is the ability to go talk about relevant topics that you're dealing with on a day-to-day basis, learn how to present, learn how to communicate those effectively, because you have chapters that are 5 people. You have chapters that are 200 people that show up. There are opportunities to actually go share your research in a small format, a large format, and to get to know other people. I mean, those are one of the best places if you want to workshop an idea or a talk. OWASP chapters are the best places to reach out because they're always looking for somebody and an interesting topic to talk about. They're some of the best places to actually go present that research, present that idea, see if it's actually something valid that people are concerned about and want to talk about. If it is really interesting and to refine those ideas, if you want to get better at public speaking or at just communicating in general, open communities in general and meetups are a great place, but there's always going to be an OWASP group around, right? Like, I've never found a location or a city where there isn't some sort of an OWASP present, right?
Yeah. And I'll say, once you've done that and done the experience of, this idea makes sense. I want to take this to a larger stage. Global AppSecs are so friendly, so receptive to first-time speakers as well, by the way, or experienced speakers. And shout out, OWASP is doing an open workshop tomorrow about how to submit to the Global AppSec CFP, Call for Presentations. I'm doing this together with Izar Tarandak and Shira Shamban. We've done this at Global AppSecs for the past few years, and it's great receptive. You might have a great idea, but you don't know how to present that. And you come and show up, and within the course of an hour, it's like, oh, now I know how to actually frame this in a better way that not only will it get accepted, but it will be interesting to audiences.
That's a good shout out. I was just trying to find the link for that. Do you have that somewhere, Avi, that we can share? Is it just on OWASP?
I'll drop that in the chat for a second.
Okay. Because that'll be a good one to actually share out. Virtual seminar. Oh, never mind. I found it. You want to be an OWASP speaker. There you go. And it's, what is that? Yep. January 14th. That's great. Right.
Yeah.
Because I get a lot of questions.
Just to be clear.
Yeah. I do get a lot of questions about how people getting into the industry. Oh, I want to go speak, but I'm really like concerned about that. How do I actually go and submit a talk? How do I know that my idea is relevant? Like those sorts of questions come across quite often, especially people that are, you know, junior to the industry.
And following on with that, Seth, when you want to move from junior to a little bit more visibility, right, to scale up just a little bit more, speaking at conferences, you don't have to be comfortable with public speaking. Studies have shown it's one of the biggest fears that people have. But you can do it in a comfortable way. And it helps. It helps the visibility.
Yeah. Yep. Good. Okay. So that was your most proud moment. Okay. What frustrated you the most about being on the OWASP board? Right? I mean, you don't have to like throw anyone under the bus, right? Like that's not what I'm looking for. But yeah.
There is a lot more operational bureaucracy red tape that we needed to deal with than I'm happy about. We spent months having to rewrite the bylaws just to get them legally accepted. Sorry, it was more than months. It was about a year and a half, close to 2 years.
Oh, wow.
And it doesn't further the organization at all, except, well, now it is legal, as legally recognized. So there's a lot of that. And that is just, there's also, we have rather often, a couple times a year, what I like to call OWASP drama. And like you said, there's a lot of different personas in the big, it's a huge community. Of course, we're going to have personas. And some don't get along with some others. And sometimes we have to start dealing with that. Sometimes we feel like kindergarten teachers, right? That's not fun. It happens too.
I mean, I think that's the nature of volunteer organizations, right? That are mostly volunteer. Since it is, right? Like everybody's kind of, they feel like, they get a say because they're giving their time, they're putting effort and things into it. There's not necessarily pay that comes out of it, right, in the same way. And so the recognition, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say there is a well on that. Well, actually, you're right.
Yes,
volunteers don't get, but there's a huge amount of value to be extracted. I'm trying to use the politically correct marketing speak, right? There's a huge amount of value to be extracted from the OWASP community, whether it is marketing for your company. And there's a place for that. We work with companies all the time, right? I'm not going to call anybody in this room out, but companies show up to sponsor the conferences, right? That's what they do. That's brilliant. Companies contribute to projects all the time, right? That's exactly what we want. There's nothing bad. It's not, companies is not a bad word, but trying to, be a little bit more sketchy with the marketing or trying to be a little bit more sarcastic about how you manipulate the community, that's not cool. And there's a lot of companies that try to do that. And there's a bunch of, top 10 projects that are created only to push a specific company's specific product or technology.
Yep.
Or because, it's great marketing for us. Yeah. So we're going to create a new top 10. Why? It's great marketing for us. And I've had discussions with several companies that have wanted to talk to me about how to create my own top 10 and be a thing. And I talked to them, what you're describing is a cheat sheet. What you're describing is a conference talk, right? It's not a top 10, for example, right? And there's a lot of other ways to manipulate the community to extract that value. And there's a time and a place for that, and I'm all for it, and I do that as well. My company does that as well. But that's not the way to do it, right? The volunteerism is for the community, is to give back, is to create that. So yes, you don't get paid, but so that's on the company side. A lot of people want to be very public, and I did this just for their own CV, which again, there's a trade-off there, of course, as well. And I'm not gonna badmouth anybody that is public about their contributions. All for it.
RailsGo helped me. I mean, doing the RailsGo project and talking about it and speaking and writing up things and giving trainings around it helped me. And I would never shy away from that. I put a lot of my own sweat equity into that project. So yeah, like, why wouldn't I? And then also, like, actually also about like the cheat sheet type of stuff, what was actually amazing for me was more, I had met when I, so I did, I worked on a, I think it was a Ruby on Rails cheat sheet a long time ago. I actually met some new people through it who I wasn't as familiar with. I already knew, like, I think Justin Collins and I think Neil Matatal were maybe involved in it, but some other folks. So you get to, like I said before, yeah, some additional networking there. Learned some things too myself by watching other people's contributions. So very, very cool. But yeah, I do see, like, it's kind of funny because, like, well, I mean, if you want to be frank, I think OWASP kind of got its roots from what you just discussed, right? Where a company wanted to put out a thing and get visibility and all that stuff. So, like, we can't ignore our roots. And that's, I got to be honest, that's always been the friction point, is that human beings are human beings. And even if money is not on the table, they're going to be incentivized in weird ways to do weird things. But when you throw money at this, and this is not a small, you know, it's not like we're talking about, you know, hundreds of millions of dollar community. It's like, we're talking billions, if not trillions of dollars, right? Here's, you know, up for grabs. So it doesn't surprise me that you have a lot of, yeah, you have some influence, some folks that are basically acting as bad actors and in bad faith for the community, even if it's not like severe, it's not surprising. That's what I would say. It just, it's gotta be hard to keep the enforcement wing sort of strong there. And it's decentralized globally, right? Like you said. So that's another added factor. It's basically just very difficult. And that's always been the weirdness of OWASP. It's like, we need volunteers and we need sponsors, but like, there's a line where, and it's not like, sure, there's some, I mean, not to say there aren't, you know, there's like brand usage and guidelines and all that. I'm not going to say there aren't. So there are definitions of what's good, and but it's still, I think, I do think it's still, for a lot of people, it's a kind of weird, like, oh, is that crossing the line or is that? I've literally been like, and I'm sure you guys have experienced this, going to an OWASP meetup, talking to the organizer, and they're really worried about like slide deck. Are you using your slide deck or using OWASP slide deck? And how much, if you're using your slide deck, are you promoting your company? And that happens like all the time. I'm certain of it, right? So I'm just acknowledging out loud that I don't think it's like an OWASP thing specifically. I just think it's a human being thing. I think there's money involved, and it's going to be a hard thing to enforce globally in a decentralized organization. I don't have answers.
Yeah, exactly. And look, it's a delicate balance, right? I mean, obviously, why are we speaking at conferences? It's obviously a little bit of promotion, right? A little bit, at least, right? Why is it worth for a company to fly you across the world to stand on stage for half an hour? Obviously, there's marketing opportunities there, and that's okay. That makes sense. We encourage that. We want to support that as much as possible. On the other hand, you know, if you can get the standard, the OWASP standard, or any kind of OWASP requirement to state, you must use this specific technology, of which, by the way, I'm the only vendor of this technology, that is multi, like you said, it's millions and billions of dollars of potential revenue there, just because OWASP specified it, right? And there have been cases in the past of companies trying to get OWASP to state, you must use this.
Yeah.
And like you said, bad actors, but it's a delicate balance, because we also do want them to contribute their knowledge and their expertise. And yes, let's not shy away from this. There are funds as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
And we need, OWASP as a community needs to give something back to the companies to justify them investing in OWASP. And we do.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a fine line to walk. And as an organization, that's, I think that's why, like, we end up talking about OWASP quite a bit, is because, okay, yes, we're OWASP members, right? Like, you know, we have been for years. We've spoken at conferences. We've trained. You know, like, I've helped run chapters, Ken has as well, right? Like, you kind of go, you fade in and out of activity and volunteerism based on what your current life looks like. But then seeing it from the outside, like the struggles that go on with being that sort of an organization and a global organization are just fascinating, especially when they have such an outsized influence on the market, to your point, Avi, is that that's the reason that companies want to be involved, right? If I can get the OWASP top 10 to call out a specific niche that is associated with me and with my company, all of a sudden my revenue like 10x'd, 100x'd because I'm one of only two players that actually offer that solution, right? Like, I understand where the incentives come from, but then 100%. As a practitioner, it also is, you know, it feels slimy when that actually gets pushed that way, because you're like, man, I thought OWASP was more objective than that. I thought there was more going into it. And, you know, we had Brian Glass on recently, right, talking about the top 10 and how that, you know, how that has become more data driven over the years. And, you know, there's not as, I mean, there's still personalities involved, but at least now there is a formal process. It's very transparent on, hey, what's going into the OWASP top 10, as opposed to, hey, there's only a handful of people that have any sort of influence that goes into it type thing. And I think that transparency is where things have started to shine, especially in the last 5 years or so. We're seeing more of at least showing how the sausage is made, right? Like, what are the decisions that are coming down? It's not just an executive director that's decided, hey, we're going to change this, right? It's, okay, we've taken surveys, we've talked to the community, we've got the board that's actually chimed in. Everything's public. Let's talk about what's actually happening, because that transparency gives practitioners this trust that they've got, you know, it's not necessarily being run by one company, or there's at least wider considerations being taken into account. Right? That's and that's kind of what I go back and forth on, is, hey, let's, you know, let's see what's actually happening and what's being driven, and make sure that that transparency stays relevant and stays top of mind, because the second that it becomes becomes less transparent is where people will start to get up in arms about things.
I just want to throw one more nuance on what you just said, which further complicates everything.
Yeah.
The project, each project, especially the top 10, runs completely independently. Mm-hmm. There are guidelines, there are policies. The board has no input or say whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So it's not just distributed geographically. It's distributed. Each project is perfectly independent. And yes,
that's what I was going to say. Yeah, to your point, like, people, because it's funny you say that, because I was just, before you said that, I was in my head, I was like, well, yeah, that's whatever. There's a lot of, like, it's funny because there's a lot of, like, OWASP this and OWASP that. It's like, man, it like, because I've thought about this, especially when I sit at those, you know, like, I saw you at OWASP DC in, I don't know, maybe October, I think, or something like that. But yeah, so I was sitting there just kind of, you know, I had time to just kind of look around at one point. And yeah, I was dialing it back on, like, all the different activities going on, the different committees, the different projects. And I was really, it was really like, I guess when you see things in person, you know, it has a different effect. And it really kind of dawned on me, I guess, and it's silly that it took so long to dawn on me, but it was like, there's no, there is OWASP, obviously, but it's not like OWASP, right? It's like this specific, like you said, project or whatever group meetup or whatever in this specific region, or comprised of these specific people that probably are so detached from, I don't know, whatever the idea of what OWASP, it's just, it's so decentralized and it's so, like, split up and divided. It's just siloed. That's the way I'm trying to, or what the word I'm looking for.
So we do try to break down the silos, but yeah, it's completely decentralized. There's a projects committee. There's a chapter committee for people to talk to, right? There's a director of projects, and Star Brown is fantastic. And she knows she approves every project that goes in, and the committee discusses it. The board has no connection to that. There's new projects that I hadn't heard about at all. The new top 10 that came out the end of last year, I hadn't seen anything about it at all until the draft release, the release candidate. Because the board, it's not the board's choice, it's the project leader's choice. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there is kind of a safety net that, and it has happened in the past, that a project leader did push their own stuff in and then it gets called out. But there's a whole process around that if there's a problem with it. Safety net.
Well, that's good that there's a process around that. I don't think we have time to go into it, but that does pique my curiosity a little bit. But all right,
complaints. You know, there's the director of projects if you really have a real complaint.
Yeah,
give that job to Seth. We should give that job to Seth. Let him bark back at people. He's really good at that. He comes off like a nice guy, but lo and behold,
I have my handle that I use, right? Like the alter ego that comes out. So,
yeah. Mr. Law. No, I made that up. Mr. Law.
Yeah, there exactly. You go. Well, sweet. Avi, we've been going for an hour. It's always a pleasure to talk. I'm interested to see again the privacy stuff as it comes out. Like, as you, yep. we might want to just do a follow up on that when the verification, like when that is fully baked and you have a release. Because I know there's a lot of developers that I deal with and security engineers that are going to want to talk through that. So it'd be interesting to at least dive a little deeper into that. Keep us apprised, or we can watch and also ping you, right? Like when that actually happens, and we'll schedule another time to actually talk about it. Fantastic. If you're up for it, that is. It'd be interesting to bring everybody in, because like the more kind of voices that we have in the room, I'd be interested to ping people on what their experience is and where they're coming from, as they have different pieces that they've suggested and different, you know, items in that list in and of itself. But yeah, we don't want to, you know, take up too much time and be cognizant that, you know, you have, you know, spent your hour with us to start 2026. Is there anything else that you would like to promote or call out before we go ahead and close things up today?
The community is us. Step up. Do something.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. I mean, that is kind of what OWASP is, right? Is, you know, if we don't do it, nobody will, right? That's how we all became chapter leaders at one point, right? Like, as it was like, hey, I think that we should do this. Oh, good. Yep. Then you're the one. Go for it.
Tell us when you're done.
Yeah, exactly. Good. Ken, any other final thoughts before we go ahead and close things out today?
No, so you're going to be, well, yes, but no. So London, OWASP training day. No. Sorry, what was the date on that one?
End of February. I don't remember exactly. 27, 28, something like that.
27. Obviously, you mentioned May 18th, OWASP Israel. My other question, so like, are you doing RSAC and B-Sides SF at all, that whole scene, or where else are you going to be basically?
Not this year.
Okay. So just that, those are kind of the two major until May. That's where we definitely know we can catch you.
Yeah, I'm hopeful to be doing this training again with Kim at AppSec Vienna in June. That's as far as I can look.
In cool. June, okay. And then in terms of people reaching out to you, any preference, like, does it matter, like, if it's x.com or LinkedIn or email?
I'm not on X that much anymore, but I'm definitely on LinkedIn all the time. Message me there is fine. OWASP, find me easily. I'm all over the place.
Cool. Okay. Cool. Well, you are all over the place. Yeah, yeah. So, awesome. Sorry.
All right. Well, again, we appreciate your time, Avi. I'm going to put your LinkedIn here on the show notes really quick.
Cheers. Thanks for having me.
Let us know how things go. Appreciate all that you do for the community and appreciate you being on the show. Thanks to everyone that was listening and tuned in today. If jump into Slack, as always, if you want to further the conversation or have questions for Ken or me. And otherwise, we will see everyone next week. All right. Thanks, all.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.